judges of the United States Court of Appeals and for the Seventh Circuit. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case this morning is Kennedy against Commonwealth Edison. Ms. O'Brien.
May I please the court. My name is Dorothy O'Brien, and Marlita Grieve and I represented Terry Kennedy and 54 other ComEd employees below. We are appealing today from the district court's three orders granting summary judgment to the company on their claims under the Fair Labor Standards Act. I'd like to begin my remarks by focusing on the Fair Labor Standards Act requirements that in order to be an exempt employee, the employee's duties must directly relate to the management policies of the company and or the general business operations. These employees are primarily in the maintenance department of this nuclear power generating company. The biggest group of the employees are called work planners, and they provide step-by-step instructions for crews doing the maintenance, modification, and repairs to the nuclear generating equipment. We also represent first-line supervisors who supervise the crews, technicians who run tests on the equipment to ensure that it meets NRC guidelines, and a largely a clerical employee called a chemistry administrative assistant in the chemical department. In large part, these are very technical workers. Most of them got their skills in the Navy, working on nuclear submarines, and they are at the bottom rung of what we would call ComEd's management structure, which historically it's been called. Another way of referring them to them might be desk employees.
But, you know, it seems to me that, I mean, obviously they're not, you know, bargaining unit people. They are in the management structure. And it seems to me your concept of general business operations is a very narrow one that seems to involve, you know, I don't know, the accountants or something like that. Why are these people not, in fact, involved in general business operations in that they create the plans, they supervise, they try to figure out what to do, either ex ante or ex post, if there's a problem?
Our first entry would be that they are on the production side of the company.
Right, but why is, I mean, I know you're drawing a sharp distinction, but some things about production must also be about general business operations. I'm not sure it's quite so dichotomous as you're suggesting.
Well, that's correct, Your Honor, and that's why we say it's just the entry. And I think if you look at the Shaw case and others, that this court has clearly said that it is not a crystal clear, sharp distinction. But if you look into the factors listed in the regulations, the planning, the negotiating, the buying, these employees really don't do that. The work planners assemble step-by-step instructions, which are closely governed by these nuclear regulatory requirements and plant procedures.
Well, of course. I mean, they have to be familiar with those requirements and procedures. They have to cull through databases and so on that are kept to decide what's the best approach for a particular situation. They aren't just automatons that are sitting there stamping out plans.
That's correct, Your Honor. And they also don't decide what projects to work on and what work needs to be done. They simply execute the decisions made by other people in management as to, for example, what maintenance needs to be conducted, what modifications need to be made on the equipment.
Well, it depends a little bit on which group we're talking about. But yes, one group, I gather, is the group that's called in when there is a problem with something and somebody says, okay, this needs to be addressed. Now we turn to your work planners to see, have them come up with a plan. That's completely inconsistent with working on general business operations, in your view?
yes, because of the narrow scope of their work and the fact that they don't really advise on any big picture type of issues. They simply assemble work instructions for the bargaining unit.
Do you think U.S. magistrate judges have to be paid overtime?
No, Your Honor.
Because they don't really handle the big picture types of issues. That's handled by Congress or the district judges. Magistrate judges spend most of their time supervising discovery. In your view, wouldn't that make them people who have to be paid overtime?
No, Your Honor, not at all.
Why not?
Because magistrate judges use a lot of discretion in interpreting the law.
They're not supposed to. In fact, they're not supposed to use, federal judges are not supposed to use any discretion in interpreting the law. Even us. Right? Congress makes the rules, we just carry them out.
Well, Congress does make the rules, and that's why we're here.
And indeed, that's the argument you've made. You've said the district judge shouldn't have exercised any discretion. All the rules were laid down by Congress, and the rules that weren't laid down by Congress were laid down by the Secretary of Labor. The district judge is just a functionary, and so are we. So do we get overtime?
That's not before the court today, Your Honor, and I don't think...
But it is an implication of your argument, is it not?
I think...
Because you say that we have no control whatsoever over the rules. Our job is just to carry out decisions other people have made.
I don't think that's a fair reading of our brief, Your Honor, or our argument.
I didn't read your brief to suggest that we had any discretion to exercise here.
Your Honor, as the court well knows, the court has huge discretion in the area, although the Department of Labor regulations are certainly instructive and helpful in interpreting Congress's intent. One of the arguments that ComEd has made throughout the litigation is that these employees are highly paid and therefore don't deserve the benefits of the protection of the statute. And I would like to respond to that at this point, outlining the balance of power type issues that Congress intended to protect employees in the workplace. If you look at ComEd and the employment opportunities for these employees, really they are limited to nuclear power plants, and that is a very small market. And so we would submit that Congress's intent in applying the Fair Labor Standards Act to this workforce.
But you would say the same thing about neurosurgeons.
Or magistrate judges, for that matter. There are a lot more of these people than there are of U.S. magistrate judges.
I mean, the fact that it's a highly skilled area is just a fact. But I don't think numerically we get anywhere. I think the real question is, in their work, you know, how much discretion are they exercising as they create these plans, as they supervise plans, as they, you know, depending obviously on which of these five classifications we're talking about. But the fact that it's only a subset of the entire work of ComEd is clearly not a reason to classify them as under the Fair Labor Standards Act, because the law is pretty clear about that. You can be only looking at one part of the business.
Correct, Your Honor. In reviewing the Sixth Circuit's recent opinion in Schaefer, the majority opinion, I thought, described it very well by saying the type of regulations that govern these jobs are so black and white that it doesn't really leave much room for discretion and for advising, you know, this concept of directly impacting management policies.
But the thing is, I mean, I would be the last to say that there isn't a lot of regulation in the nuclear power industry. There, of course, is. But I suppose most tax lawyers would think that there's a lot of regulation out there, too. And if there's this massive regulation out there, somebody with a mastery of it is going to need to pick their way through it and find exactly how that all applies to the particular equipment failure or the particular problem facing oneself.
That's certainly true, Your Honor. And certainly a skilled auto mechanic has to sort through all of the guidelines of pertaining to repair of cars and the parts within them, and yet nobody would contend that an auto mechanic or a person who writes procedures for an auto mechanic would, that person is skilled and that person is non-exempt. Regulations clearly say that although skill is very important, it doesn't really mean you're exempt. You really
have to. No, there's certainly a difference. I absolutely agree. There's a difference between being skilled and being on the administrative side, and that difference gets down to how much judgment do you exercise in applying that skill. Skill is probably necessary, but not sufficient.
I see that my light is on, and I would like to reserve time for rebuttal, so thank you for your attention.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. O'Brien. Mr. Graham.
May it please the court. The district court granted Commonwealth Edison 3 summary judgment motions.
Did it grant Commonwealth Edison's motions or Exelon's motions?
Your Honor,
plaintiffs seem to think the defendant is Exelon. You seem to think the defendant is Commonwealth Edison. Who is the actual employer?
Currently, the employer is Exelon Generation. But that has never been changed in the caption of the case, Your Honor.
But then we had better get it right. Why would you put the wrong employer down?
And initially, when the lawsuit was filed, the employer was Commonwealth Edison. That changed in October of 2000 when Exelon Generation took over these power plants.
But there, actually, I had a similar question because I was wondering if there is actually a corporate entity anymore, Commonwealth Edison Company, or whether Exelon Generation has, in that sense, you know, taken it over, because we routinely will bring changes in corporate identity up to date.
Your Honor, I think it's a ministerial act that the plaintiffs just failed to change.
Why do we care about the plaintiffs or anybody else? It is Exelon Generation now, right?
Currently, the current employer is Exelon Generation, but the claim, certainly from the period January of 2000 to October 2000, would be against Commonwealth Edison.
But so is there a Commonwealth Edison still? Is it a separate corporate?
There is, Your Honor. It doesn't have nuclear power plants anymore. It just has wires and transmission operations.
So there was an asset transfer?
That's right, Your Honor. Now,
who do you represent?
I represent the defendant in this case, which is listed as Commonwealth Edison.
Who do you represent?
Commonwealth Edison.
Then I'm not sure that you are entitled to practice law here. You are listed as an employee of Exelon Business Services Company.
That's right, Your Honor.
And my understanding is that lawyers are allowed to practice as part of corporate entities only on behalf of the corporations. So the General Counsel's Office of General Motors can represent General Motors, but it can't represent some other entity. So if the correct defendant here is Commonwealth Edison, I don't understand how Exelon Business Services Company can send a lawyer to represent it.
Your Honor, Exelon Business Service Company is essentially a captive law department for all of the subsidiaries and entities of Exelon Corporation, which includes Exelon Generation Company.
Generation is the right defendant, that's fine. But if what happened is that Commonwealth Edison sold assets to Exelon Generation and retained the liability in this case, then it's not fine.
Your Honor, Exelon Corporation also continues to own Commonwealth Edison. Those are two subsidiaries.
I think the parties had better file memoranda within 7 days after the argument explaining who the correct defendant is and why, and who will pay any judgment in this case.
Yes, Your Honor. We'd be pleased to do that. Your Honor, this case can be decided based on 5 decisions that this court has already made. The Haywood decision, the Demos decision, the Shaw decision, the Piccione decision, and the DeJory case. The Haywood decision was written by Judge Ripple, and Judge Easterbrook concurred in that opinion.
It is completely unimportant who writes or concurs in decisions of this court. They speak for the court.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Your Honor, the key issue here is whether these employees exercise independent judgment and discretion. However, the standard of how much exercise of independent judgment and discretion is disputed by the parties. The plaintiffs have taken the position, based on the Schaefer case, that the level of independent judgment requires customary and regular exercise of that judgment. That clearly is not the standard under this court's Haywood or Demos decisions, which state that only the primary duties must include independent judgment and discretion. And based on the reading of Demos and Haywood, that requires a very low standard of exercise of independent judgment and discretion.
Where do you get in Haywood or Demos the idea that, you know, 5% independent discretion is enough, you know, some de minimis amount? Surely, for this statute to have meaning, there needs to be some significant, if not more than 51% component of the job.
Well, Your Honor, we have to work backwards from that. The definition in the regulation of exercise of independent judgment and discretion says it needs to be more than occasional, but less than constant. And the standard under
why
the
why doesn't that land you sort of around 50%?
Well, Your Honor, but the point is that the standard under the short test is actually even lower than what the standard is under the long test. So I would posit that the standard is something less than what is required under the long test. So it's something more than occasional and less than constant. In any event, Your Honor.
That sounds like the Weather Bureau's forecast. Our rain will be more than occasional and less than constant, but how much that is, you have to guess.
Well, Your Honor.
Is there any way to be more precise than that?
Well, I think, again, this is an area where the court has to exercise some of its discretion as to what is appropriate, but we have demonstrated that on a day-to-day basis, these employees absolutely exercise independent judgment and discretion. As we pointed out with the planners, the planner's entire job is to sculpt a set of materials to instruct somebody in the field in a radiated environment how to do their job as efficiently and as correctly as possible. And those types of responsibilities are specifically the types of responsibilities that have been identified in the regulations. For example, 205C3 says that an employee who makes analysis of data and draws conclusions is exempt.
But, we have these kinds of cases all the time. There have been a whole slew of cases dealing with nurses, for example, in facilities who certainly exercise a lot of skill. They have to look at each patient. They've got to make decisions. As it were, you know, they'll take the data and come up with some plan for people. And a lot of those nurses have been found to be squarely under the Fair Labor Standards Act. And only maybe the supervisory nurses who stand out from the crowd are exempt employees. Why isn't that more or less the same here? Of course, these people do some planning, but there's a lot that's already pre-fab, if you will. There are prior plans that have been used. There are prior parts that have been used for the people who are selecting the parts from the various vendors. Somebody else is taking a look at it. Why doesn't this fall on the skill side as opposed to the administrative discretion side?
I think, Your Honor, because they spend so much of their time incorporating into these existing plans new information which they're gleaning from what actually happens out in the field, what's happened at other nuclear power plants, what their experts are telling them about ways to do things, and the plan here is always to get better and do a better job of this. Your comparison with the nurse, it's much more similar to a grader. A nurse is identifying a lumber grader. A nurse is identifying, that's an example used in the regulation.
I know, but I'm just thinking that the nurses might disagree with you,
well,
since they are in fact entrusted with a lot of responsibility.
Sure, but they're also reporting a lot of information to doctors to identify what the problem is. They might make a recommendation occasionally, but a lot of what their information is how is the patient specifically doing and what's the latest information about it. Much like a lumber grader, what's this piece of wood or whatever?
And it's up to the nurse to decide, has the point come where we have to call the doctor back in again? That could be a really big decision.
Absolutely. Now, the difference, though, is that for these planners, every project is incorporating over 40 different parameters of information and using lessons learned from prior experiences to make a determination as to whether the current plan for this is the correct one or it needs to be changed. And they have a tremendous amount of discretion as to what they're going to start out with in terms of a background. And again, the key thing here is, given the nuclear safety aspect of this, they are looking at a tremendous broad breadth of things to make sure that their plans are the most effective and the most safe, again, in a radiation-related environment. Now, again, I think that the best example in the regulations is the data system exempt employee. It says that the data system employee who is exempt determines exactly what information must be used to prepare the necessary documents and ascertain the exact form in which the information must be presented. That is almost a verbatim description of what the plaintiffs say they do on a day-to-day basis. And that's found in the regulations at 541-207-C7. Now, as this court has already pointed out, the jobs of these employees are critical to the overall operation of this business. The maintenance of the plant and to maintain the license of this plant, the plant has to be operating correctly. And these are the employees who identify exactly every change that's going to take place in that nuclear environment. And for that reason, it's clearly related to the general business operations. But it's also connected.
Well, of course, so is the work of the people who they're supervising once they've come up with the work plan. If they don't do their part of the process right, you'll have a failure, hopefully not catastrophic, but some kind of failure that needs to be addressed. So importance to the business is a kind of a fuzzy line, isn't it?
Well, again, I think that in addition to the general business operations, it also, the exemption also applies to people who carry out management policies. And here, it's uncontested that the regulations and the requirements of the business are included in these work plans, so that the employee who goes out into the field to operate is basically being told by the planner exactly what management policies he needs to follow. So for both the reasons of management policy as well as the role in the general business operation, I believe that the employee satisfies the direct relation test. Now, turning to the salary basis of employment, the Haywood decision is very instructive on the requirements of the salary test. And here the plaintiffs have made a significant argument about the fact that these employees are paid for additional compensation when they work additional hours is somehow inconsistent with the salary test. And that's clearly not the case law. The court has made that clear in accepting in Haywood that employees can be paid for leave banks and also for paid for their overtime hours without any inconsistency with the salary test. So that leaves us with a group of 54 employees currently who are executing their jobs in consistent with independent judgment and discretion, operating according to the salary basis of employment, and performing tasks that are directly related to the business operations of the company. And for those reasons, these employees should be considered exempt under the Fair Labor Standards Act as the district court.
Was there ever a time, does this record show, before your 2000 reorganization, that they were in fact paid time and a half for overtime?
They were paid different ways.
Well, I understand that the formula's changed, and I understand that maybe some people are actually getting W-2s with numbers bigger than they used to have, but did they ever just, I mean, there must be a yes or no to this, were they ever paid time and a half?
They were paid time and a half their regular rate of pay, calculated purely on their salary divided by 2080.
Right, okay.
But the regular rate calculation, as this court has pointed out in several other cases, is a very complicated transaction. It includes certain payments and additional payments of overtime and shift premiums and things like that. And I don't know if the level ever was sophisticated enough to include all of those payments as well.
Okay.
Mr. Graham, may I shift your focus slightly? I'm concerned about these staff specialists.
Yes.
Particularly Ms. Warren, Mr. Kaufman, what in their particular job descriptions makes them exempt? I thought the district court did a rather undernourished analysis of these two people particularly, and I'd like to get your view on it.
Sure. Well, turning to Ms. Warren first. Ms. Warren is in responsible for our, essentially, the leak detection program to make sure that...
I'm sorry, I didn't...
It's leak detection program.
Yes.
It's essentially to make sure that portions of equipment are not leaking in any way, leaking air out of the containment vessel into the atmosphere. And she does not physically perform any leak tests. She analyzes the data that comes out of those tests and tries to create formula and identify what essentially predict future leaks as a result of information that she's receiving. And so as a result, she's definitely engaged in an analysis type role as opposed to some sort of a manual type of role. She worked at a desk, et cetera. My time is up, but Mr. Kaufman...
You have a minute to go.
I'm sorry. Mr. Kaufman...
As long as you're answering a question.
Okay. Mr. Kaufman is responsible for all scheduling of chemical tests within the plant, and also does... He's essentially the administrative assistant to the chemistry department and performs all of the tasks for the actual head of the chemistry department. He's not a secretary, but under the rules, administrative assistants are, in fact, exempt if they perform scheduling and organizational things, and he operates fairly autonomous. The plaintiffs identified him as a clerical employee. I believe that the record is very clear that he does not operate clerical.
Brings me to my next question, is where in the record will I find a comprehensive description of these two individuals' responsibilities?
In our appendix, we attached all of the facts which plaintiffs have admitted which relate to those two positions, and those identify in specifics what exactly those two individuals do.
Thank you very much.
Thank you
for your time. Helpful.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, counsel. Anything further, Ms. O'Brien?
I'd like to go back for a few minutes to the Schaefer decision out of the Sixth Circuit. There they commented that in the nuclear industry, with all of the many regulations and restrictions, that there may well be fewer people who operate with discretion and independent judgment than in other industries. And we would submit that this is certainly the case on this record for these employees. For example, the fair labor or the first line supervisors, in assigning their work, which ComEd claims is where they exercise independent judgment, they are strictly limited by a qualification matrix, which is maintained by the training department, certifying each crew member on the union crew as to whether they're qualified to perform certain aspects of certain maintenance procedures. And so given this tight restriction, in combination with many of the other duties of the first-line supervisors, which are sort of clerical in nature, really, answering email, coordination, getting the schedule from workweek managers, and then just implementing, assigning the work to the crews based on this matrix, really leaves these people with not very much discretion, if any at all.
Is this the basis upon which you would answer Mr. Graham's suggestion that the regulation dealing with systems and analysts is not appropriate? He suggests that 541-207C7 really ends the case.
Your Honor, systems analysts, I don't believe any of these employees would qualify under that regulation in the plaintiff's view on this record. Also,
you just disagree with him on that.
Yes, Your Honor, we do. I'd also would like to refer the court to, we did a chart in our reply brief, which it's on page 6 of the reply brief, which refers the court to specific references in the index for description of particular aspects of the duties of all the positions. I'd like to also refer the court to the Spinden case, which I believe was favorably cited in the Piscione decision, and contrast the duties and responsibilities of that plant controller with the duties and responsibilities of the employees in this case. That person attended senior management meetings, was involved in high-level planning, accounting-type audits, in contrast to these employees who attend, really the only meetings they attend are scheduling meetings for their own work. And certainly there's no evidence of any senior management advice going on. And finally, just a few comments on the salary test. We believe that under the totality of the circumstances and looking at all of the factors, it would be fair to conclude that these employees continue to be treated as hourly employees as they were prior to 2000.
Well, they weren't hourly employees. They've never been that in a technical sense. They've always had a salary, right? They've been in a category where they, in some fashion or another, which is what I was trying to get at, were paid more overtime than they were after the 2000 reorganization. But you're not saying that they got hourly checks, and so if they worked 6 hours in a day, they got 6 hours pay.
We are saying that, Your Honor.
I think the record showed that. I mean, ComEd has suggested that they've always been paid salaries.
We would respectfully disagree with that characterization of the record. We believe it shows that they were paid time and a half and double
That's
time.
That's different from whether the paycheck at the end of the month was a salary.
My understanding is they previously had more docking than they do now, and that their paychecks have always and still continue to reflect their wages as an hourly rate.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.